And moving on to item five, presentation from staff and Angelo Gordon regarding potential commitment to the Angelo Gordon Energy Credit Opportunity Fund.
Thank you. I'll just give a quick introduction to why we're taking a look at this, where it fits in the overall plan, and I'll let Jeff walk through the actual underwriting of the investment thesis and why we settled on Angelo Gordon as a recommendation. We're recommending this fall under the opportunistic allocation. Back in 2009, there was a proposal to allow up to 5% into investments that were temporary in nature and did not fit neatly elsewhere in our portfolio lineup if we thought there was a chance to capture outside short-term gains. So the investment threshold is it has to be accretive to the overall fund, has to be a higher expected rate of return than what we expect to achieve on the rest of the fund. In this case, we have done a couple of investments in opportunistic over the years. It's been a while, and a number of the trustees were not here for the last times we did opportunistic, but we did a private investment fund with Oak Tree, which is still hold as an opportunistic investment. We've got about $30 million in that one today. And we had done a mortgage, a dislocated mortgage strategy with Goldman Sachs, which was liquidated a couple years ago, very successfully. So we have up to about $360 million that could be deployed into this space. We have $30 million currently. So the recommendation today is for a $75 to $125 million range of allocations here, relatively modest in the grand scheme of things. So let's talk about why we're bringing something forward to you today, why there isn't dislocation in the market. As we all know, the price of oil dropped considerably towards the end of last year. We can talk about the drivers of that. The fact is the Saudis chose to pump more oil than they have historically. They have traditionally responded to the rest of the oil producing community by adjusting their production up or down to maintain price stability. They are not doing that today. They are maintaining volume, and therefore the price has come down on globally traded oil. We don't know why. I don't have insight into the Saudi budgetary process, nor does anybody else. But the fact of the matter is it created a set of conditions that we're responding to. So what do we know? In the United States, the oil and gas sector has expanded dramatically from where we were a decade ago with the advent of fracking, shale gas production, general oil production with the high prices brought a lot of new production online. We had new companies. They were financed by banks in high-yield debt. They were heavily levered. And so that expansion created the big, robust opportunity set. So what do we believe to be likely but don't know for sure? Well, the companies expanded and issued debt into a market with $100 oil, generally speaking. Sometimes at 70, sometimes at 120, sometimes somewhere else, but at an elevated level relative to medium-term norms. The fact that the price volatility has increased and the fact that the price is down is probably going to lead banks to consider their end clients to be less creditworthy than they were a year and 2 years ago. Their reserves are less valuable. So you've got companies operating with the reserves in the ground that just have a lower mark on them because it's marked at the spot price of oil or gas, as the case may be. And the banks are likely to pull out both from that volatility of their client basis and from the pressure they're getting on the regulatory side. If they've got a volatile loan on the books, they're going to have to put up greater reserves against it. They don't want that. They're getting the regulatory push and they're getting the price volatility input. So we believe the banks are going to restrict future lending here. So,
Tim, who decides if it's volatile? I mean, what are they using, like, how do they gauge it?
How do they gauge it?
Yeah.
Price of oil. So what they're saying is the banks are looking at this and saying, we judge the creditworthiness of the oil companies and gas companies we're lending to based upon their proven reserves in the ground, and then we attach the current price of oil or gas to that. So those proven reserves, by and large, let's say they haven't changed. They've proven, you know, 10 million barrels of oil in the ground. Well, 10 million barrels of oil at $100 and 10 million barrels of oil at $50, well, you know, the value of that company that I'm lending to was cut in half. They are less creditworthy. The cash flow they can generate is cut in half. Now, candidly, we don't know what that spot price is going to do. All we can say is that shift, that drop, that dramatic 50% decline, and now it's crept back up somewhat, but that sharp drop was scary. It was a, let's call it a unknown unknown. Nobody knew it was coming in, and say they didn't look for it. Well, oil and all commodities tend to be volatile. The fact that it wasn't volatile for 5 years doesn't mean it's not going to be volatile in the future. So banks are looking at this and saying, I've experienced volatility, and my regulators don't want that on my books, and they're going to make it more expensive for me to hold that. So we're looking at that contraction of credit.
Is that like a rating agency? So no matter what bank is looking at, the same volatility?
Well, the banks are operating under various regulatory schemes, but I mean, the Basel III global rules are just basically saying, think of it this way. We want, collectively, our banks to be better capitalized. We hear that all the time. So if they've got something, you know, a loan on their books, and the end user of that loan has a cash flow profile that moves up and down, well, I mean, think about it if you're getting a mortgage. If your income varies by 50% per year, the bank issuing you the mortgage is going to want a lot more collateral up front, and they're going to, it's going to be more expensive for them to issue that loan. That's what we kind of have going on here. So in terms of conditions that set this up, that's what we're looking at. So about 4 months ago, we within the investment office said there's a potential for a dislocation here. There's certainly a dislocation in the price, and there's a potential for dislocation in the companies, for the companies to get in trouble. But what don't we know? We don't know what the absolute level of price of oil and gas is going to be. Anybody who tells you they do doesn't understand the folly of prediction. So we just want to be very cognizant of what we don't know and how it could potentially, the market could evolve away from us. We don't know what the supply of oil is going to be. If Iran suddenly is opened up to shipping oil into the global markets, that brings oil in line. If the Saudis act differently than they have over the past 6 months, that is going to, you know, be a shock to the system. And we don't know, although we believe it to be likely, that banks are going to restrict their lending. They could do extend and pretend. So we took a look at this and said, we don't necessarily want to take on additional commodity risk exposure. We don't just want to buy oil futures. We wouldn't recommend that to the board. Launching a private equity or a public equity play into acquiring these companies and hoping for a price rebound, again, seemed a little too risky to us. And so what we quickly focused on was, what can we do within the credit space? Can we buy and restructure some of these high-yield loans? Can we originate new debt on better terms? Are there going to be dislocations, chances to do distressed credit, to, you know, buy the credit of a company if they're in trouble, foreclose on the equity piece, and become the new owner? And you know, recognizing it's a very dynamic marketplace, we wanted to find a partner that we already knew and who had a track record of deployment of capital. So Jeff is going to walk you through what we actually looked at, how we approached the research, and why we settled on Angelo Gordon.
Sure. Yeah, so kind of three main points to touch on in our research process was, first, where in the spectrum of energy did we want to focus? It's a big umbrella. And we have a general preference for being as close to the asset that we're trying to capture the economics of as possible. For us, that meant upstream oil and gas. These are the companies that banks are doing enormous amounts of lending to. These are the companies that have the reserve-based lending that effectively acts as the collateral for the lines of credit that they receive. And so this is really where the dislocation is happening. Downstream from that, services, other even energy producers such as coal, independent power producers, have been impacted. But the economics to drive forward are much different than focusing exclusively on the oil and gas. So we wanted to focus there. On the credit space, the unique opportunity here, again, is not a rebound in the commodity price of oil. This isn't a bet saying that oil is going to go back up and we're going to benefit from that. We're seeing a credit consolidation where banks have been pressured for a while, longer than even before you know, the oil price drop, to get away from really volatile lending. Like Tim said, putting up reserves is something they don't want to have to do. The oil price drop is the volatility that they have been trying to avoid, and basically a light was shined on, you know, what's going on. So banks are looking at this and saying, we need to reduce our credit lines here. This is shown in the most recent Federal Reserve survey as banks are, you know, reducing. Some banks have already started to reduce credit lines. Other banks are intending to. With the recent boom price in oil, as companies were over-leveraged and getting into the industry, loans were being made because it was very profitable. And these were covenant light or even no covenant loans, which in a period of credit consolidation from the investor side is a unique opportunity to come in at the higher end of the capital structure. So to come in at senior secured, at a senior secured level, giving you a first bite at the assets should anything happen to the company, provides the downside protection that a mezzanine level or even equity doesn't. So should a company go through bankruptcy, mezzanine and equity will likely be completely wiped out. Even what has historically been the senior level of their capital structure, based on recent loans or at least recent debt issuances, could be wiped out. So our ability to come in and get a first lien on the assets is attractive and provides downside protection. With the credit side, there's credit again is a broad umbrella, and there's three ways you can kind of play the credit. There's the public markets, and that's looking at high yield debt. As the oil price moves around, the high yield debt will move around as well. Generally, as oil price goes up, the high yield debt prices will follow. The yields will go down, the risk will be perceived as less. So that's one side. When we did our research, we spoke to our current fixed income managers, reviewed if this type of strategy was, you know, something that they could pursue for us. But it's a little bit of a rifle shot, and it's still inherently a bet on the commodity price of oil. Direct lending, this is a new thing for Angelo Gordon, and we do have the head of that practice here to talk to you today, which is actually originating loans, acting effectively as a bank, underwriting and lending directly to the energy companies that had previously received credit from banks. This is the opportunity specifically to write better terms and come in more senior in the capital structure. And distressed debt, this is something that we've done in real estate. This is kind of the pennies on a dollar debt purchases with a restructuring in mind that will provide value on the upside. When we looked at roughly 11 different private equity funds in addition to the conversations we had with our current debt managers, and we wanted something, considering this is a dynamic opportunity, we wanted a dynamic approach to it. The Angelo Gordon Fund, the Energy Credit Opportunities Fund, uses all three of these credit approaches. They're not statically held, so whatever opportunity is presenting is where they intend to deploy capital. They don't have a hard target for distressed debt, a hard target for direct lending or high yield trading. The presumption is that distress will come later as banks are, reserve-based lending has a revaluation twice a year, generally around March and April and October. So as the reserves are revalued, banks are reconsidering their maybe distress later in the market. The fund we felt was structured opportunistically and that it's a drawdown vehicle, meaning that its capital is, fees are only paid on called capital. The preferred return is a European waterfall, meaning that it's on the total funds and not a deal by deal basis. So the incentive is for Angelo Gordon to draw capital when there is an opportunity for an investment that is accretive to a total portfolio return of at least their preferred return of 7%. This is what we felt was a good alignment of interest between the investor and the GP. This relies heavily on their prudence of capital deployment. There's an inherent assumption that they want to earn more than the management fee paid. We believe that to be true. And so this fund, with somebody that we've worked with before that we know, we feel like we can trust their prudence of capital deployment, seemed to be a unique fit for attacking this opportunity. With that, if there's any questions, we can...
Yeah, and I think, you know, just to echo Jeff's point, the fact that we're only going to pay on the money that they call and deploy, so we're only paying on invested capital, we thought was a mitigating factor for the fact that we don't know how this is going to unfold.
And as I read this, that was 150 basis points?
Yes. Yeah, this is a private equity structure. It is, you know, these are not cheap structures, as we well know.
Here we believe that net of all fees, we're going to likely achieve a rate of return superior to what we would achieve in the fund aggregate. You know, we can ask Angelo Gordon their expectations for what the net to limited partners return will be. I would say we're probably looking at low double digits would be our base case scenario. Downside is they don't deploy the capital or they don't deploy as much capital. Upside, obviously, you know, it, to the extent they can buy, if they buy securities quickly and the price of oil rebounds quickly, those securities are going to get very valuable. But we're not going to be able to deploy future capital. So there's a lot, there's a wide range of unknown factors here. But we thought the fact that they are attacking this through three distinct angles on the credit space, you know, we truncate the upside and downside case scenarios here, and there's that middle swath that we think that the credit consolidation is probably the area that we can get the most comfortable with, is that it'll come to fruition.
Come back again with that.
We're not betting on the oil price rebound, and we're not betting on Armageddon. We're betting on the credit consolidation. So the bonds that these companies are issuing are going to be impaired, and you're probably going to have some mergers. You're going to have some restructurings. There will be fewer oil and gas operators, but presumably at a better quality, we can be part of making that happen.
How does that impact if oil does go up in price? What happens?
Whatever they have bought at a discount, or even, you know, if they bought a cheap asset that's based on today's oil, that asset then gets priced up, and they have an opportunity to sell it.
We would capitalize on it.
Okay. So the risk is if we have a very fast rebound in the price of oil, whatever they have managed to buy is going to do well, but they might not deploy a lot of capital.
Got it.
And if they don't deploy a lot of capital, well, the fact that we're only paying on invested capital, it's a small but successful investment to us rather than an undeployed capital that we're spending money on. That was a mitigating factor that looked like it was a good step in the direction of alignment of interest between both parties.
Two questions. First one is, how much do we currently have invested with Angelo Gordon in other funds?
We have commitments of...
It was $65 million this last fall, and I think it was $75 million to the previous fund.
Right.
The commitment from this last fall is not yet drawn. They're using their line of credit, but they have made purchases. And from the $75 million from the previous fund, I think we're nearly...
So $140 million.
$140 million committed. Deployed would be probably less than half of that today.
Yeah. Okay. And then the second question is Angelo Gordon versus others that are competing in the same space.
We felt like when we reviewed the other funds, a lot of funds were kind of a straight rifle shot on one strategy, a direct lending fund, a distressed fund, an equity fund. We felt like a lot of funds came to market. That is one of the things we noticed at this point. Given the dynamic approach, the dynamic opportunity, we wanted something relatively flexible, and we didn't see a lot of flexibility in other funds, at least not flexibility that we would say came from a deeper team. Angelo Gordon's, the genesis of their firm is distressed debt, then credit, and direct lending is a new thing for them. They added that team in 2013.
So diversity in investments.
They had the breadth that got us comfortable. Other folks had comparable depth, but together under one heading, there's not a lot of shops who can do it and had an offering.
And do they have specific experience in the energy industry?
That was the new addition in 2013 when they got Todd Dittman and his team that came out of the direct lending, the banking space in Texas of doing, underwriting loans to energy companies in Houston. So that was the addition. We have the folks who understand credit and folks who understand trading at the mothership in New York, and then they acquired this new team in Houston specifically to focus on energy lending.
And they have done distressed and high-yield trading in energy before, not in a dedicated energy fund, but they do have experience with those issuances.
That is a real key differentiator here. A lot of the funds that came to market were bond specialists. They know bonds. They know how bonds trade. They know how the dislocations look. But what we heard when talking to our peers, other systems that were attacking this problem, some of the funds, was... You know, you can't necessarily look at this from a strictly financial standpoint. You need somebody in your team who has the oil and gas expertise. And that doesn't mean you need a geophysicist who's going to go out there with sonar and remeasure everything, but you need somebody who understands who the players are, how they think, how the banks are going to respond to them, and just is a little bit more on the inside of this industry, because we are taking a narrower focus on one industry here. It's a big industry. It's a big commodity. It's a key commodity, but it is one industry.
You're really touching on exactly, I guess, what I've been thinking about as you make your presentation, and in many respects, is going to depend, at least in a significant part, on picking the right borrowers. And that's a classic loan officer type role. And we're dependent upon Angelo Gordon's ability to do that in this wide range of potential borrowers out there in the field, picking the right ones.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's if it's well secured, we have a fair amount of protection, but people can still run companies into the ground. I think where I'm going on this is and you've really already touched on it to some degree, your comfort in the quality of their people to do that. And it sounds like it's a fairly small group, and it's a fairly recently acquired group. And how much risk are we in if they should disappear or turn out not to have the basic skills that you're looking for?
You nailed it. And that's why we negotiated a key man provision where if the leader of that team leaves, they can't deploy another dollar. Mm-hmm. So that was our backstop there. We did reference checks on the team, on the key individuals, on their prior firms. We went through our contacts in the banking industry to try to understand what the reputation was, what's going on in that industry. While we're never going to dial into absolute perfection, we got comfortable that this was a team that we could underwrite and that it fit the broader theme of Angelo Gordon. So.
There's first compliments on the analysis. It's extremely thorough. I think I learned a lot. There seems to be a real, I'm intrigued with this, but there seems to be a real sweet spot on this. If you go through the risk analysis, there's upside risk, downside risk, and you really got to have kind of that Goldilocks spot in there. If the price of oil stays about where it is or just kind of floats up gently, then we're probably okay. If it goes up quite a bit, then the banks may not be pulling out as fast.
Yes.
And so the opportunities are fewer for us. Or if it drops precipitously, then the banks are going to bail even faster, but there's a downside risk for us too. And so am I wrong in seeing that there's really that kind of sweet spot we've got to hold on to?
I mean, you're characterizing it as sweet spot. I would characterize it as two countervailing forces.
I don't even understand what that means. So.
Let me try to use some plainer language. If the price of oil drops precipitously, we have richer hunting grounds, right? The credit is further impaired. The companies are going to consolidate to a much greater degree than they would otherwise.
Isn't there a point of diminishing returns on that? I mean, if it becomes that much of a risk, they're not going to be able to afford the debt service.
At which point we'll foreclose.
Right.
Okay. On the assets.
Candidly. All right. It wouldn't sound that simple, but okay.
Wait, no, it's not that simple, and that's why we found a partner who has the ability, who's taken the company through bankruptcy, who has written a loan. I mean, these are incredibly complicated actions here. We talk about the headline of, you know, can we write a loan or can we foreclose on a company? Sure, simple, easy, right? No. You need somebody who understands the legal side, the trading side, and the industry dynamics. That's what we looked for. That's where we got comfortable with Angelo Gordon.
Because you don't want to go to North Dakota in the wintertime and check out shale deposits.
I love North Dakota in the wintertime.
You forget where he comes from.
Right.
Yeah.
That might be an upgrade from where I grew up. I mean,
there's always Houston in July as well.
Yeah, Houston in July is also. Yeah.
Your opinion, where are we at on the cycle? As far as when timing, and is it a good time now, bad time now, going to get worse, going to get better?
We don't know. All we know is that the conditions have been set up that would allow for dislocations in the market. The fact that the next reset on the reserves, on the value of the reserves, this reserve-based lending, is going to be September, October. Mm-hmm. If the price of oil is at 50, then there's going to be some distress. If the price of oil is at 80, then there's probably going to be very little distress. But we know between now and October, we're setting ourselves up for to respond to what happens in October. Okay. So if nothing happens in October, guess what? They don't call capital.
Right.
They don't buy anything.
And there's also a level of kind of behind-the-scenes distress that's going on. There are impaired companies operating right now that may not actually just be able to continue to operate. So distress is, in the view of Angela Gordon, going to be later stage, but it's something that is unfolding bit by bit over time. Okay. So the opportunity set isn't exclusively riding on, you know, the October reset. There are firms that are hurting right now.
Okay. But if we do see an inflection point, that would be the first inflection point we'd be looking for. Shall we bring in the team?
Sure.
All right.
Girl, you wouldn't like
yes, that's right.
I have many shale deposits in Hawaii anyway. Yeah,
got a refinery. You got the refineries out there.
Yeah. Let's get the oil from somewhere else.
Morning.
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 It's an easy spot. Great. It's nice to see all of you. Thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to be here today. We want to be very mindful of your time and want to make sure we stay within the allotted time. So, Chairman, do you have a time frame for us that we should work with it?
Half hour.
You want to introduce them?
More like that.
Great, great. Thank you.
You want to introduce the board to them? Start.
Sure. You want to start?
Yeah. Sure.
we'll go around the table and introduce ourselves. There's a few new board members that you may not have met yet. Jerry, you want
Jerry
to start?
Jerry Holcomb, trustee.
Hi, I'm Candace Anderson. I'm a new trustee. I'm the appointee of the Board of Supervisors.
Pleasure to meet you.
John Phillips, trustee.
Todd Smithy, trustee.
Gail Stroll, CEO.
Brian Hass, trustee.
Scott Gordon, trustee.
Jerry Tellis, trustee.
Rusty Watts, trustee.
Deborah Allen, trustee.
Louie Quill, trustee.
Gabe Rodriguez, trustee.
Well, nice to see all of you again. Thank you for giving us the opportunity. You've been a great partner with Angela Gordon over the last number of years. We appreciate your continued support, and it's a great pleasure to be here to talk about another area of Angela Gordon in addition to real estate. So joining me is Todd Dittman, and Todd joined the firm a couple of years ago, and he is leading our energy lending business. So we now have a Houston office where Todd and his team reside, and then to the left of Todd is David Kamen, and David has been at the firm for 21 years and is the co-portfolio manager for AG Superfund along with Michael Gordon. So what we thought we would do today is talk about the opportunity set, why we structured the fund the way we have, the different strategies. Todd will talk about the energy lending piece. Dave will talk about the structure we put together, and then the two underlying corporate credit strategies, that because this is a three-pronged approach. Many of you, I should not say all, since there are a couple of new board members, are familiar with the firm, so I will be brief with my comments, but at any point, we are happy to answer any questions that are Angela Gordon related or obviously fund specific. But Angela Gordon is a 26-year-old, $27 billion alternative management firm. If you look at the firm, there's really two core strengths. It's credit and it's real estate. And we have a lot of underlying strategies under each of those headings and some strategies that are a combination of the two.
Angela? Colleen, if I just jump in just for a moment. The meeting is being recorded, so we've all introduced ourselves. We all know you, but just for the record, could you just state your name?
I apologize.
That's all right.
I'm Casey, and I work in the Marketing and Client Servicing Group with Angela Gordon.
I'm Todd Dittman in Direct Lending.
I'm Dave Kamen, Multi-Strategy.
Great, thank you. Angela Gordon is a privately owned firm. There are 63 partners at the firm. We work with about 350 institutions. We work with many state pension plans. We are also privileged to be manager for a number of different SACRs, so the various California counties. Angelo Gordon's philosophy has always been to match money with opportunity. We seek to size funds based on an opportunity set, and a number of different instances we've raised funds. If an opportunity goes away, we will return the capital. So we always like to have the right alignment of interest with our investors and also really just be not market timers, but just very much in line with how we think we can put the money to work in any designated opportunity. We have a couple of pages that talk more about the firm. On page 6, this is really just the evolution of Angelo Gordon. We're a very opportunistic firm, always looking to find additional strategies that have good synergy. You know, a great example of that is Todd and his team joining. Todd will tell you a little bit about his background and how he fits on the AG platform. And then the other pages just reference, you know, our asset growth and things like that, which, again, we're very mindful of not raising capital, raise capital, but really to match it and seek opportunity. So with that, if there are no questions about the firm, I'm happy to turn it over to Dave to talk more about the opportunity set and how we structured this fund.
Sure. Good morning, and thank you very much. When we first started looking at this opportunity, obviously oil was going down, and we can talk a lot about why oil went down, but to us, it doesn't really matter. Once we see an opportunity, we want to try to get our forces together and see if there's anything we can do. You as investors can invest in a variety of instruments. You can do private equity, equity, listed equity, high yield, acreage itself, the commodities themselves, but that's not what we're about. I mean, as Colleen stated, we're really a credit firm. And we sort of got together really at the bequest of other reverse inquiries from our clients saying, you have a Houston office, you have a credit team, are you doing anything? And that sort of inspired us to think, what can we do? And so what we came to was, why don't we approach it the Angelo Gordon way? And the Angelo Gordon way is credit, and really being at the top of the capital structure, looking to the downside first, and then also being flexible. So we had three distinct areas, and Todd is going to speak a lot, and I'm going to be fairly brief because I think Todd is the anchor to everything that we're doing here. Since we have energy direct lending, we have distressed, we have non-investment grade groups. We figured if among those three groups, we could find a portfolio, and again, looking to the downside and not really being predicated on the movement of oil. You know, we are not a commodity shop. We're not a currency shop. We depend on credit and real estate. So we figured, could we put a portfolio together which is resilient enough, even if oil stays here and or goes down, that we could get returns where we think are achievable, which are 12 to 15%. And I think the answer was yes. And we had long conversations about it. And what we did was we crafted a portfolio that looks very similar to the multi-strats. So on the co-portfolio, our multi-strat portfolio, it's about $5.5 billion. That invests in distressed convertibles, merger arbitrage, CMBS, RMBS, ABS, as well as to a lesser extent real estate and private equity. So the concept was, well, we don't know where oil is going to go, but we want to be flexible enough to move money to where we see the best opportunity. So the three prongs really are non-investment grade debt, energy direct lending, and distressed. And we'll get into later what we think, how it's going to play out. The answer is, at the end of the day, we're not really sure because it is solely dependent on the price of oil. I think, again, Todd's anchor is going to be a big part of the strategy regardless of where oil goes, and Todd's going to get into the reasons why. But I think in all three areas right now there are opportunities. Not so much in distressed. Distressed we think is going to be a latter part of the investment theory, but if oil certainly stays at $60 towards the latter part of this year and early to next year, you see a lot more companies file. To date, I think 11 or 12 companies have filed in the oil space for about $4 billion total debt, but we think that number is going to increase. We expect filings to continue for the rest of the year, but these are companies that probably aren't things that we would be interested in at this point, but the bigger companies I think are going to start feeling pain going forward towards the end of the year. So what is the actual approach, and what will the portfolio look like at the end of the day? And if you take a look at page 11, this sort of gives you some concept of at least where we think or what we think the portfolio would look like given certain prices of movements of oil. So if oil was, say, here today, it would probably be a fairly even distribution at the end of the day. If oil goes up from here, it's still direct lending will be still, we think, a huge opportunity. And again, Todd will go over that in much greater detail. And as far as oil going down, well, that's only going to create more distressed. I mean, every day oil goes by at 60, you see the distressed opportunity, you see weakness in the high yield market. So I think people are starting to come to realize that it's going to be a very difficult proposition for a lot of companies to survive at 60. And for, again, talking about distress specifically, it's not necessarily as a particular cycle where you have a balance sheet problem. A lot of these are just non-economic at $60 oil. period. And the oil might be in the ground, the gas might be in the ground, but can you actually extract it and be profitable given your cost structure? And I think that's going to be the real trick. And one of the things, if you take a look at the next page, you have three separate groups, but they're all working together really for the same cause. And bringing all three groups together is essential, because what Todd's group brings with the industrial knowledge, basically looking at hundreds and hundreds of companies to get that private information that is really inaccessible from the public market. If it was not for Todd's group, we would not have this fund. If we just had 10 people up in New York office looking at screens trying to figure things out, we would not be doing a separate fund. But with Todd's group and their industrial knowledge and their insight into what's going on at the companies we're looking at, that helps us with the secondary market where we can't get non-public information. You only have to rely on that public information. So from my standpoint, one of the things I do for a living with the multi-strats is have people talk to each other and constantly communicating. And that's part of the Angelo Gordon philosophy. We have to communicate. And that is essential to this fund. So we have weekly meetings, that are dedicated weekly meetings on Tuesday, but there's constant interaction between all the groups as we're looking at these companies. And I think, again, that is essential for the firm as a whole. It has served us very well over 25 years. But for this fund, I think it's going to function. And just talking a little about this fund and the opportunity that we're seeing, we've done this several times in the past. When we see opportunities, we go out and we raise dedicated money either for structured products, RMBS, CMBS, or we've done it distressed. And the other thing is we don't feel that we have to put money to work. If the opportunity is there, we'll put money to work. We don't feel that pressure. We're aligned with our investors. We want to basically put the money to work if it makes sense. We also want to give money back if it makes no sense and the investment opportunity is left. I think our greatest fear is that oil is going to go straight back to 100. Now, nobody, I don't even think Todd, believes it's going back to 100 within next year. But, generally they're more optimistic down in Houston. That is the biggest, I would say the biggest risk factor here, is all of a sudden oil goes back to 100 and all of a sudden a lot of these companies work again. So, but from our vantage point, we still think that oil will remain at these levels in the, say, $50 to $65 range. And that's where the opportunities are going to really pop up. As far as the team, we have 15 people who are dedicated to this fund, six who are in Houston, the rest up in New York. And again, they're all working very closely together. And, that is paramount to making this fund work. But that all being said, we think this is an opportunity in time where we think we can put money to work the way we put money to work, looking to the downside, figuring the upside will take care of itself. And with that, I will leave it to Todd to talk more about the industry and more specifically about direct lending.
Thank you. I'm going to start on page 19, but before I go there, as Dave said, we're very patient. Since we joined Angelo Gordon, we've looked at over 600 transactions. We're not in a rush to put money to work. And in fact, what we found in 2014, before the oil crash, was that seemingly the whole world felt like they had to be in energy, and we saw sloppy deal structures, we saw cheap pricing, and come Thanksgiving Day, I dreamt we would be lending money to Exxon at 15%, and that's not exactly what happened. What we have seen since that time is frustrating efficiency in the market for larger transactions, $300 million and above. For smaller transactions, we've seen the companies really become non-creditworthy because they can't support their cost structures anymore at half the price of oil. They've got lease operating costs per unit, G&A costs per unit, et cetera. And so the question for us, which we felt positive about, was, is there a mid-range of transactions, a lot of transactions from which to choose, where we can get the rates we want, where we can get the structure we want, where we can require the companies to hedge, to lock in their oil and gas prices for the term of the loan or longer. We look at about a deal a day, and lo and behold, over the last couple of months, it seems as if those transactions exist. But it is absolutely in the range of sort of $50 to $200 million size transactions below the size that Jefferies and CS and other agents take transactions to the market, but above the size required for them to be true, of a scale and size to be very good credits. And so we've got, and this is today's snapshot, we've got about $400 or $500 million of stuff in backlog in various degrees of certainty, from $135 million, of which one, a smaller one, is closing today. A $75 million deal is scheduled to close by the middle of July. We've got two $75 million proposals out in final term sheets, and behind that, we've probably got about $200 million worth of stuff percolating. This is all first and second lien secured. It's all 3 to 4 year type maturities. It all comes with 2-3 maintenance covenants and hedge requirements, things you simply are not seeing in terms of the broadly syndicated market. So, to page 19, why do we care about that? We care about it because we have no idea where oil prices are going. All we know, and if you look at the last analogy for this scenario, in the 70s, the Texas Railroad Commission gave the full production order. That's the equivalent of removing cartel control of volumes and pricing. That's what's happened here. And so what we expect is volatility to spike or to stay higher until the Saudis settle on a different policy. In that environment, we think it's extremely important to be first or second lien secured at the top of the capital structure, not bet on oil price recovery, require hedging, and have the borrowers be able to amortize credit based upon $60 oil locked in for 3 years. And that's the approach we take. As I said, if you look at page 20, it's not easy to find the deals we like. In fact, if you look at the broadly syndicated deals, and there's a number of them spread across the middle of page 20, these are unexciting and from our perspective, kind of frightening deals. 8-11% coupons, they claim to have liens, which they do, but they're structured like unsecured high yield, no maintenance covenants, no hedging requirements, no structure, and relatively cheap rates. This isn't what we do, and it's really what you do if you're sitting on a desk in New York without a sourcing channel and without seeing a deal a day that doesn't get shopped to a bunch of people. And our sourcing channels are proprietary, and it's extremely important to our business. And so we see transactions from people we know directly in the energy patch, because we've done this somewhere between 20 and 40 years, depending on team members. We see things from regional banks that call us directly and go no further. And we see things from shingle-hanging intermediaries in Tulsa and Oklahoma City and Lafayette and Midland and Amarillo. It's an intermediated model, but it's sort of a proprietary intermediated model, and that's how we find these extra basis points and this extra structure. And so we avoid, you know, when Jeffries calls, we listen and we take the call, but it's not likely we're going to be doing that transaction, because Jeffries does too good a job with bigger transactions, showing them to the world and competing out the structure and competing out the pricing. That's not our model. What our model is this sub-$200 million financing market, that if we find it, we will do it, and if we don't, we won't. And so, but we're seeing it. And every day, as Dave said, every day that goes by, at $60 oil, we're going to see more and more of it, because what's happening throughout 2015 is these companies have these $90 hedges that are rolling off, and they're replacing $90 sales with $60 sales, which is a massive hit to EBITDA, it's a massive hit to borrowing base, and it simply creates the opportunity for us to replace bank credit that's priced at LIBOR plus 3 with our credit, which is priced at 13, 14, 15% yields to worst. And so it's an exciting time, but it's a time where we're being cautious and staying at the top of the capital structure and simply waiting for the banks to withdraw and create the super senior secured high yielding opportunities that that we expect will come and will continue to come.
Is there a danger? I mean, well, this is going to be a real naive question, but is there a danger in this play that you could have literally a long-term sustained current condition in the energy markets? That is, whatever the Saudi paradigm is, remains indefinitely, say 5, 8, 10 years.
Are you saying, can oil remain at $60 for 5 or 10 years?
Yes.
I think the answer for us is absolutely. And so we have no idea. And that's, again, we're not predicating oil going up. We create sensitivity now to oil going down more than anything. But can it stay like this for a long time? Absolutely. And I'll talk to this. He's the expert. But I mean, if you're seeing changes in technology, which are incredible. So you're seeing the output from individual wells go up tremendously. You're seeing costs come down. So it almost incentivizes people to continue to drill. It's not as if we think that the profitable basins are going to continue to produce, and they're producing from their best wells. So that could extend for years. I think every time I look at a piece of research, you know, people just say, well, it'll go back 75 or 80 within 12 months. I don't think that's factoring in the expansion of production in Saudi Arabia. They have more rig drilling now than they ever have. So they're not only not cutting back, they're increasing production, as well as in the U.S. And we're getting more and more efficient about getting that oil and extracting that oil and gas from the ground. So could the 60 be the new normal 100? Sure.
Yeah,
I don't know if you think differently.
Yeah, but I don't think there's a danger to the lending proposition, because we are valuing things, haircutting valuations based upon $60 oil, not former valuations based upon $100 oil.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, this is not what I do, so I'm trying to feel my way through this, but if you have a persistent state of oil price at 60 or thereabouts, and you have firms that used to operate profitably at $90 a barrel and whose reality has changed, and now there are $60 barrel companies and they're, you know, having to go to these opportunities to finance themselves to keep going, how long does that persist?
Well, that's the interesting thing for us, and I sort of touched on it a little before. It's not a balance sheet issue. So we've gone through distress cycles before where a company has a balance sheet issue. And if they just rejigger their balance sheet, then they'll be fine. In this case, you need massive amount of money to put into the ground. So because every time you produce, you have to replace that production with new reserves. So money constantly has to be going into these companies. So you will see companies, we think, just go away. Probably smaller right now, the worst companies that we've seen that have filed. In fact, we were just talking about one yesterday, which we had looked at to give a loan. It's a good chance it could just go away. And you know, that's what's so different about this, what we expect, the stress cycle. There will be tremendous amount of pain. We're already seeing pain in the drilling service companies. You see it in the press. I mean, massive, massive layoffs. But some of the knowledge which Todd gets, you take a look at drilling companies. You know, we were talking about one company which we're doing due diligence on, and it's for prospective drilling. Well, the drill used to cost from the $7.5 million. Well, now it's $5 million. But the contract this particular company is looking at is based on a success on the well. So they're actually taking $2.5 million, and if the well hits, then they'll get their $5 million. If it doesn't hit, it's $2.5 million. So you're talking a 66% drop. That's what they're risking now. So drilling service companies and drilling service companies are the ones who are going to be at risk. They're the first derivative of E&P staying at this level. So I think, you know, 60 is going to be painful. I mean, if it stays like this, it's going to be very, very painful for the industry.
Yeah, but I mean, if you're in the debt side of this and you have a number of failures in that sector, you I guess foreclose, you can take over. My question is, well, what do you have? I mean, I guess I'm burdened by the distressed real estate thing where the whole game is basis and you go in and you get it. And the whole play is the commodity price, real estate, goes up, right? Everybody's happy. It's wonderful. You flip it and life goes on. But I don't understand the end game here. Well, that's what I'm struggling with.
It's our job to underwrite the asset bases that would be interesting to people if we foreclosed upon them. And so we're not going out and saying, aha, replace the bank in every one of these situations, because in a lot of these situations, the cost structure is screwed up and the drilling economics are wrong. And so you would be bailing the bank out and left with a problem if $60 oil happened for 2 or 3 or 4 years. We have an engineer, we have all this experience, and I mean, we're underwriting one right now in the Bakken where we looked at the last 29 wells, group them by cohorts of time, and had to convince ourselves that these economics are still holding up, because although we're only underwriting production, and the industry always pays for production at today's prices, we'd still like there to be some serendipity and some extra value should we ever have to foreclose and not be nail biting about can we get every last dollar, get our bait back, get our accrued interest back. And so
yeah, I mean,
it's our job to find the better assets.
Right. It's proved, developed, producing. So they're producing assets that we're underwriting to. So oil and gas is coming out of the ground. I mean, the real problem is if oil becomes, even when they're producing, you shut in a well. Prices have to be really low for you to shut in a well. I mean, you're talking $20, $25.
Yeah.
So could oil go that low? Of course, theoretically, it could. Very, very hard to imagine. But that's really as draconian it has to get when we're underwriting PDP, to the, you know, again, producing in the ground, but coming out That's what we're trying to do.
The problem you describe is more is a more common problem with mezzanine-based lending. This isn't mezzanine-based lending because we never go beyond the proved developed producing value of these assets. And so worst case, the old style bailout of amortization is our takeout at hedged production.
Thank you.
I've personally had my head handed to me a couple of times in real estate having a second lien. Talk a little bit about the difference between first and second and how much security there is in when it's a second.
So those broadly syndicated transactions I just spoke about, the intercreditor on those deals allows unlimited first lien to come in on top of the second lien. That's my nightmare. Mm-hmm. On the deals we're talking about, the intercreditors we put in place cap first lien at a very small amount. For instance, one of the ones we're working on is a $75 million first lien behind 20, I'm sorry, second lien behind 25 a first, and we're permitting a total of 35 a first. The intercreditor terms we get when we consider second liens are far, far superior to the stuff that's getting done in the broad market. In addition to which, we require that they get our consent to release collateral. So even if there's a 25 first lien ahead of us and a 75 second lien, unlike market standard intercreditors, the first lien can't simply release the collateral on our behalf. We have to vote for the collateral to be released. And so we've got much better protection.
What's the total expected value or projected value of the 25, 75 against 200, 300?
We're typically underwriting to about a 60% loan to value through our last dollar.
So 180, something like that. Okay. Yeah.
Do you want to go through fund terms?
Sure. Would you like us to walk through the terms of the fund?
Sure.
If I can direct you to page 30. Target net IRR is 12 to 15%, as we discussed. It's a two-year investment period with an option to extend for one additional year, and the harvest period is 3 years, and we also did put in the two additional one-year extensions. And there are expected distributions for this fund, semi-annual distributions, which is a target of 5 to 7% per year. And the management fee is 1.5% of net funded capital. So what this means is that this is on invested, not committed capital. So with your investment, as we draw capital, we will then charge a management fee. And then the incentive is 20% subject to a 7% preferred return and 80-20 catch-up. So everything is back-ended. It's not deal by deal. So you get your money back, the preferred return, and then the performance is distributed. And Angelo Gordon is making an investment 2% up to $20 million.
What's the time frame for closing?
We've done our first close. We closed about $150 million. As Todd mentioned, we're getting ready to close our first deal next month, and we will do rolling closes from this point. So we expect to have the fund wrapped up in the fourth quarter, and we have a target size of $750 to a billion.
Is there a dollar price of oil if oil were to increase from this point? Is there a dollar price that you would estimate that this would no longer be a viable investment?
I think the direct lending piece is the stickiest piece in terms of that risk, because what we're really doing is replacing bank capital. And the banks run these base case price decks, and they like to be at about 80% of market. They found themselves at about 110% of market by virtue of the fact that market moves so fast, and they're still catching up. And right now, their price decks are at 100% of market. And so if we had, one, if prices stay the same, we expect them to continue lowering their prices. If prices fall, they're certainly going to lower their prices. If prices increase, they're going to hang out right where they are until the buffer is reestablished. They're at 80% of whatever the increased price is. And then it's an issue of this very painful memory slipping into the past in a sufficient way for them to eagerly get back into it. I think that buys us a couple of years of runway at least. I mean, what we're hearing, we just saw a Bloomberg article that the bank examiners are saying, hey, you guys aren't amending and extending and being easy on these borrowers. We've got an eye on you. And we haven't even hit the valley of that issue yet, because October, the second borrowing base season comes around, and there are going to be more problems, not less, because of these hedges that are rolling off. So I think there are a number of factors that at least from a direct lending perspective, permit this to hang out for quite a while.
So the majority of the assets of any of these companies are the reserves?
Correct.
So if you come in and foreclose, you're basically going to be looking for someone to buy the reserves.
Which is why we typically don't lend more than the production, because it's easy to sell reserves for production value.
Two questions. Why did you leave Global Hunter Securities and join Angelo?
I had formed a vehicle called Poydras Capital, and one of my larger investors was to be the CEO of Global Hunter. And so he offered me a spot to sit and some assistance in putting the materials together while we were getting our act together. He's still a dear friend, but as an anchor investor, Angelo Gordon was simply a much better anchor investor than my friend. And so, and Colleen and her co-workers are much better at raising money than we were. And so we met Angelo Gordon, and it was an instant match, and they raised us our first fund. And
real faster.
It was just a blessing.
Okay. Second question, how long are you going to be around?
Well, this is my dream job.
You sure?
I am sure, yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's much better to be on the buy side than the sell side. And when you consider, I've done about 140 transactions across my career, and two-thirds of those are principal as opposed to sell side. And when you look at principal, I mean, I started my career at Texas Commerce Bank making energy loans. Uh-huh. All I've done is make energy loans. It's just I've had to go with the firms. As the financial services arena has evolved and banks really aren't lenders anymore, they're capital markets transaction chasers, I've had to go with the firms that are lenders. And so now you're in alternative asset management land, and Angelo Gordon is the nicest set of New Yorkers I've ever met.
I mean, I've been there. I was born in New York.
But, you know, as far as tallest dwarf in the yeah, whatever.
But as far as the management, I don't know if there's a slide here, but people generally go to Angelo Gordon and they stay. I mean, it's a nice place to work. We give you plenty of rope to hang yourself with. But the most important thing is that you have to buy into the culture. And the culture, as I mentioned, you have communication, collaboration. We've had people come in who refused to do that. And if Todd's group was not talking to the other parts of the firm, he'd already be gone. Uh-oh. So, but that's the most important thing. If you buy into the culture, you stay a long time.
How many people from your team came with you?
All of them.
So which was how many?
There were four of us.
Four of you, thank you.
And we've subsequently hired two since we've been here.
Okay.
And the one thing I would add, Jerry, I just want to add one thing, is one of the benefits that Todd has mentioned to me is that he can actually manage his team and buy assets versus we have a very, very elaborate compliance, legal, marketing, accounting. So to come on a very established platform and infrastructure, it allows him to really run his business, which it sounds like that's what you were hoping to do all along. It's just, and it was very much plug and play, if you will. So I think that's something to add.
That's okay. I think you, Todd, said that kind of a little throwaway line, but you said you have an engineer in Houston.
Yeah.
So you have, you got lots of people. I have no qualms with somebody doing the numbers crunching. What does that engineer do? What kind of experience does he or she have, and do they have a corner on wisdom about what's in the ground, or what are they looking at?
He has a corner on skepticism, because what he does is when we require our borrowers, when we enter in a discussion with our borrowers, the borrower tells us what they think the reserves are. Then we require a third-party firm to tell us to further reduce the borrower's reserves. And then my engineer takes that third party's firm's work, puts it on his engineering software, goes well by well, looks at historical lease operating expenses, considers the area and what we know from other deals that we've done and looked at in the area, and he ends up reducing it further. So by the time we decide what V is in LTV, the value, it's been looked at by the company, by a reputable third party, and by David. And David has 40 years experience, both industry and finance. And I feel wonderful that we're protected in the downside in terms of what somebody may pay for this collateral. So he draws upon that experience and goes well by well in a very laborious process.
Do you ever make site inspections, or is it all?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. We do. We do it ourselves, and we typically hire a group called the Wood Group, which does operational assessments and inspections and environmental inspections. You know, we had a borrower, the Wood Group spotted some rust on one of the platforms, and we called the borrower rust. We got some rust, you better get after it. I mean, it's a pretty detailed due diligence exercise.
So you're not finding vaporware when you go out there later on and say, what well?
No. This is detailed. This isn't underwriting based on a book.
He sent me a picture from his hotel room when he was in the Bach, and I couldn't believe the place.
Same picture doesn't come through every time, right?
No. I mean, there's a picture of me climbing a tank in the Bach and look to be sure there was something inside the tank. We do that.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Any other questions?
I've got nothing. Okay.
Thank you very much for the presentation.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the opportunity. If you have any other questions, please don't hesitate to contact us.
Have a nice day.
Thank you.
Thank you too.
A lot of people don't know that when he looked in that tank, Jimmy Hoffa.
The nicest bunch of New York people.
That seemed to be the best takeaway line from that presentation.
That's classic, yeah. That's good.
Good stuff.
Soundbite.